You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, you know, when something has genuinely hit bottom, and in this case, the Romney campaign, and I'm not talking about Joe Scarborough going, oh, no, you know, on TV this morning and all that kind of, that's gone viral. But it's when a piece that is written as satire goes viral as the real thing. Right, when you write a piece of satire, you know, Andy Borowitz, we do the Borowitz Report, so, you know, with Andy's permission here on the program on a semi-regular basis is our cheesy news alerts. The one we did yesterday or the day before was about how, you know, Romney's trying so hard to lose this election, and he keeps, you know, doing this and this and this and this, and his campaign, you know, his head of his campaign is going, yeah, we really, when we got over to London, I said, Mitt, there's no way you can screw this up. Mitt said, you just, you know, give me a chance here, buddy, you know, that kind of thing. Well, that's obviously satire, right? I mean, you read that and you go, okay, that's obviously satire. So this is a piece that Roger Simon, who, you know, writes for Politico, in fact, he's their chief political columnist, or at least was this morning. It's going to be really interesting to see what this does, if anything, to Roger Simon's career. He wrote an article that he intended to be a work of satire, a joke. And it got picked up from one end of the world to the other. I mean, it's literally gone viral all over the world as a real news story because it was published on Politico. It was by their chief political reporter, and buried deep down inside it. And I, frankly, I've read this article twice, and I can't find where it's buried deep down inside it. It's something about PowerPoint presentations being used to euthanize pigs or something like that. But even Raw Story, they're saying, Raw Story regrets the error of taking Mr. Simon at his word. But here's the story. And you tell me if you think that this might be credible. I mean, particularly after we saw the John McCain campaign meltdown and kind of come back 4 years ago. I mean, it's just like, you know, this just makes, this actually makes sense. Could it be? Could it be that Roger Simon originally wrote this as a straight news story, or there's a good chunk of it that's a straight news story that he later, you know, when the news got out, he said, oh, we can't have that. We're going to have to. Or could it be that this is going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy? I mean, this is, okay, so you don't know what I'm talking about. Let me share a little bit of this with you. The headline, now, this is the headline over at Raw Story, so I'm assuming this is the same headline that they picked up from Politico, but perhaps not. The headline is, name-calling begins as reported rift opens between Stench Romney and Gilligan Ryan. Congressman Paul Ryan has apparently gone rogue, is now openly mocking his running mate. He is nicknamed Romney the Stench. Meanwhile, top brass at the Romney campaign have taken to referring to Ryan as Gilligan. Really? And then Roger Simon writes, it was former political director of the Republican Party of Iowa, Craig Robinson, who said to the New York Times on Sunday, quote, I hate to say this, but if Ryan wants to run for national office again, he'll probably have to wash the stench of Romney off him. Now, I'm assuming that that's an actual quote that Roger Simon put on there, although maybe he made that up, too. I haven't, you know, there's not a hot link in there, so I don't know. It could be just, you know, he made the whole thing up. But it sounds credible. I mean, that's the thing. The remark has been taken up by Paul Ryan as an inside joke in the campaign trail. Politico's Roger Simon reported that while Ryan, quote, had already decided to distance himself from the floundering Romney campaign, he now feels totally uninhibited. Reportedly, he has been marching around his campaign bus saying things like, quote, if Stench calls, take a message and tell Stench I'm having finger sandwiches with Peggy Noonan and we'll text him later. Could it be? Meanwhile, according to Simon's anonymous sources, the Romney Brain Trust of senior campaign officials in Boston have taken to calling Ryan Gilligan. Why would they call him Gilligan? Because it turns out, quote, he's turning out to be an intellectual flyweight. Now, keep in mind, this is Roger Simon is now saying, oh, this was just satire. The turning point allegedly came last Friday when Ryan addressed the AARP and earned boos from a crowd that included his 78-year-old mother. This embarrassed him in front of his mother. On Saturday, Ryan went off script and rebelled by delivering his stump speech as a PowerPoint presentation. And then they, you know, go on to say when the campaign reacted angrily, Political claimed that Ryan responded, let Ryan be Ryan and let stench be stench. In a way, it's like a commentary on how bad this has gone. I mean, just how badly everything has gone for the Romney campaign. It's just, even as a satire, it's a good commentary. And the fact that it got picked up by all these websites as a real news story, and now, you know, even Politico, I mean, they're going out of their way. No, oops, we didn't mean, no, it's satire. This is just a joke.
Satire alert.
Maybe. But I'll bet that this afternoon, Paul Ryan's going to tell a stench joke on his bus, and Romney's going to tell a Gilligan joke on his plane. Things like this, you know, kind of have a way of taking on a life of their own. Meanwhile, privacy. Let me want to riff a little bit about privacy here. Because, frankly, I think most Americans don't get it. Back in 1773, 3 years before the American Revolution, in the fall of 1773, a fellow by the name of Rusticus, that wasn't his name, it was his pseudonym. We still don't know who it was. We believe that at least one of the pamphlets attributed to him was actually written by Samuel Adams, but nobody is even sure of that. Started posting flyers, bulletins they called them in the day, on houses, on trees, that were pretty off the wall. Actually, no, I don't have a copy of Unequal Protection here within grabbing range, and it's no big deal. But I quote a number of these in my book Unequal Protection, and it's just these were open calls for rebellion against the East India Company with regard to the tea, and these anonymous posters led right to the Boston Tea Party. Period. End of discussion. I mean, that happened. And the founders and the framers of the Constitution, particularly Jefferson and Madison, got it that if you want to have periodic revolutions in America, and I'm not talking about violent revolutions, although that's what ultimately the Boston Tea Party led to the American Revolution, but we've had a series of revolutions in America, whether it's the end of slavery, arguably that came about as the Civil War, the enfranchisement of women, the Civil Rights era, the gay rights era, I mean, on and on and on. There have been a number of revolutions, prohibiting alcohol, re-legalizing alcohol. There's been a lot of them. They had nothing to do with violence, but they all came from the people. And in many cases, they came from the people organizing anonymously. Because they knew that if they tried to organize out in public, or if the government, or if the corporations that they were working against in some cases, I mean, keep in mind, our country was kicked off on an anti-corporate act of civil disobedience and the destruction of private property, the Boston Tea Party. But had those people known who they were, they couldn't have done it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I want to explain a little more about how privacy is essential to democracy and how we're losing it, and ask your thoughts on what does privacy mean to you, and do you think this generation gets it?
You say you want a revolution, well, you know. But when you talk about destruction, don't
Don't you know that you can count me out?
Yes. Well, nonviolent protest has always been the most successful. Violent revolutions tend to produce, I mean, sometimes they produce really significant change. That's how our country got started. But frankly, over the long term, and you know, there's a number of, David Swanson actually makes a very good argument in his book, War is a Lie, that even the American Revolution and the Civil War did not have to be fought as wars. That they could have been just as successful had they been nonviolent actions. But anyhow, it's increasingly looking like the United States is about one generation away from completely forgetting what privacy means. And the consequences of that great forgetting are going to be tragic for our nation. Because without privacy, without the ability to be anonymous, Americans can't even plan a peaceful revolution or nonviolent progressive social change movements. Because if big corporations or Big Brother are watching, they can block efforts before they even become public. Seriously, in recent years, we've learned about the massive surveillance systems being built by the corporate state. For example, we now know about the warrantless wiretapping of American citizens after 9/11. We know about TrapWire as a law enforcement tool. It keeps track of our movements in major cities across the nation through closed circuit cameras, facial recognition software, and license plate readers. And we know the enormous spy center being built by the NSA in Utah. It's going to house just like zillions of things, our emails, our phone calls, our text messages, all of it in one place. The NSA can now hold the digital version of 500 quintillion pages of text. That's a lot of data. What's worse, Americans are increasingly willing to give the surveillance state and snoopy corporations whatever they want. Right? Oh, hey, isn't this cool? And I go to the New York Times, it gives me ads that are just exactly what I'm looking for. Louise and I really noticed this after her cancer diagnosis and, you know, with breast cancer, which has so far been successfully treated with surgery and chemo. But to the point, she did a lot of Googling about breast cancer, and now pretty much every website she visits, she gets ads for everything from chemo wigs to cancer treatments. And it's like, huh? How does this website know? We're sacrificing privacy for convenience and interconnection. We're enthusiastically posting our locations, our pictures, our personal information on sites like Facebook and Twitter. I mean, you know, people are starting to figure out this might have a backside. It might kick them in the butt when they're, like, looking for a job. And all of a sudden, the pictures from when they were 17 and drunk are there for the world to see forever. But even worse, all of these are monitored by the corporate surveillance state and by those corporations themselves. Your web experience is now carefully compiled and examined so big corporations can make more money advertising directly to you, targeting you. How do advertisers know what you want? Because they've been collecting data on the websites you go to and what you search for, and they're reading your emails. All of this arguably is a blatant violation of individual privacy, but when you say, yes, I click on the terms and conditions, yes, I read those, no, you didn't. I know you didn't, you know you didn't. And as a consequence of that, online data collection is now a multi-billion dollar industry. This level of surveillance would have been unthinkable from the founding of our country. In fact, our founding fathers held privacy to be one of the highest rights. They wrote it into the Fourth Amendment. And today we just accept these invasions of our privacy. But in Europe, they're not accepting it. Citizens in other democracies are not as naive or as passive as Americans, at least in Europe. Under pressure from the EU, the European Union, Facebook has announced that it's scrapping its facial recognition software and deleting all the data that they got from it. But here in the U.S., they continue to use it. Even though people like the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, is opposed to it and speaking out loudly about it. We just don't have the laws that are needed here in the United States to protect privacy online. And as long as advertisers can make bucks, big money on knowing your habits and your secrets, we're never going to have those laws because Citizens United gave those advertisers the right to buy your members of Congress. Congressional Research Service. Now, this is not, I mean, it's got nothing to do with any political party. It's a permanent research branch of Congress. They issued a report that said, quote, there is no comprehensive federal privacy statute that protects personal information. Instead, a patchwork of federal laws and regulations govern the collection and disclosure of personal information. And it goes on and on. So can you imagine? I mean, in Europe, there's a Bill of Rights for online users. It's called the Data Protection Directive. And in Europe, they've got new laws coming down the road to protect people, online users, and hit governments and corporations with heavy fines. The Europeans have figured out this is a big deal. Now, just consider, Rusticus posted this. This is from my book on equal protection. Rusticus published, you know, posted this thing on the wall, or on a whole bunch of walls and trees and whatnot, all over the place. Are we in like manner to be given up to the disposal of the East India Company, who have now the assurance to step forward and aid the minister to execute his plan of enslaving America? Their conduct in Asia for some years past has given simple proof how little they regard the laws of nations, the rights, liberties, or lives of men. They've levied war, excited rebellions, dethroned lawful princes, and sacrificed millions for the sake of profit. The revenues of mighty kingdoms have centered in their coffers, and these not being sufficient to glut their avarice. Maybe they were talking about Bain Capital. I don't know. And these not being sufficient to glut their avarice, they have, by the most unparalleled barbarities, extortions, and monopolies, stripped the miserable inhabitants of their property and reduced entire nations to indigence and ruin. 1,500,000, it is said, that'd be 1.5 million, perished by famine in 1 year, not because the earth denied its fruits, but because this company set the price so high that the poor could not purchase them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the question, had the East India Company known who Rusticus was so they could have him arrested or shut down, would we have had the Boston Tea Party, the American Revolution?
When it was in full eyes, you can't escape my private eyes. They're watching you. They see your every move.
Yeah, what happened to this idea of privacy? This Fourth Amendment. In fact, let me read you the Fourth Amendment, because it's just, I mean, you know, it's only a sentence. It's very straightforward. And Shano, who's actually graduated from law school, says the Third Amendment also guarantees your right to privacy, because it, you know, the Third Amendment is the one that says you can't quarter soldiers in someone's home. But it implicitly also says that you can't go into someone's home without their permission. I mean, it's not explicitly in there. The Third Amendment reads, no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner. But that's pretty close. But the Fourth Amendment really nails it. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Now, keep in mind, this is government which is constrained, not Google. Not Apple, not AT&T. For them to be constrained requires you and me. Consumers need to say, no, come on. Really? Facebook is going to be working with Datalogix, and they're taking my Safeway frequent shopper card that I use to get a $2 discount when I go to the supermarket or whatever. I don't know that they actually use Safeway. I use that as an example because I actually have one of those cards. There's a Safeway store a couple of blocks from where we live. But they're using these frequent buyer cards, and many stores have them, or even issue their own credit cards and use them as them. And information from credit card companies and information from online vendors about what you bought. Combining that with information, you know, about where you're going and what you're doing online so that they can always throw the right ads at you. And in fact, you know, the number that I believe it was Facebook was pitching the other day is that for every dollar spent online, they can track $3 of additional purchasing outside of Facebook. In other words, the ads are working. Why? Because they're targeted. Because when you see, if you and me were both to hit the same Facebook page, we'd see completely different contents in terms of the advertising. And not just Facebook. I mean, this is, I don't mean to pick on any one company. This is ubiquitous. This is everywhere. Because they're keeping track of where we've been before. Now, they're saying, oh, well, we're aggregating this information. So it's not just you. It's everybody like you as well in one giant lump of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people. Right. Maybe true. Now, but what's it going to take? You know, I think young people who have participated in the Occupy movement are starting to get the importance of the right to privacy. People who have, the young people who showed up in Minneapolis back in 2004 to protest the RNC, the Republican convention there. Or was it 2008? Whichever year it was, I was there. I guess it was 2008. And had their, you know, literally before they even had a chance to go out and protest, their house got, you know, their doors got kicked in. They got busted. Infiltrated. Monitored. I mean, at what point do we say enough? And at what point do we all get it that you can't have a functioning democracy without dissent, and you can't have dissent? The highest form of patriotism, according to Teddy Roosevelt, you can't have dissent in many cases without anonymity, without the ability to anonymously dissent. I find the whole thing quite remarkable, quite remarkable. Robert in Lawrence, South Carolina. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Good afternoon. You were talking about right to privacy and so forth. Some years ago, I had a bout with the kidney stones and spent a couple of nights in the hospital. And so the doctor told me that the best preventative medicine for that would be to get a water filter. Well, after I was discharged from the hospital and came home after about 3 days, my phone rang and I answered it, and the fellow on the other end congratulated me for winning a 1987 Pontiac Grand Prix. Well, I said, I've entered no contest. He said, no, says all you have to do is buy a water filter and inform your friends and neighbors about it.
And that so, puts you in the contest, you mean?
Well, no, that was a scam.
Oh.
You understand what I'm
saying?
Yeah, so... I shared information.
Yeah, and this is part of that. There was this law passed some years back that, in fact, I remember it was a dentist's office I was in, and they said, you've got to sign this. It's part of the something or other. There's an acronym for it. It's not HAVA, but it's something like that. This new law that was supposed to, you know, allow the aggregation of electronic data and all this kind of thing, and it was sold to us as it was protecting our privacy, our medical privacy.
Yes.
And, yeah, the HIPAA Act, H-I-P-A. And the HIPAA Act, actually what it says is, and you sign it when you go to, every time you go to a new doctor, you know, every doctor has to have it on file once, and you read it and it says, we have the right to sell your information.
And so you sign it unaware of what's going on.
Right. Yeah.
I have a question for you, if I may.
Sure. Sure.
You said that Google and so forth cannot be barred from coming into your house. That is violating the right to privacy. They're a part of a corporation, and a corporation is a person. I mean, I may be a little facetious here, but...
The Constitution doesn't stop persons. It only stops the government.
Okay, it only stops the government.
And this is what Obama was criticized for by the McCain campaign when he was playing law professor four or five years ago, and he said the Constitution is a bill of negative, or is a charter of negative rights. And he was absolutely right. What the Constitution says is, here is a list of the things that government can and, most importantly, cannot do. It doesn't say what you and I can and cannot do. That's the job of the legislature to create by virtue of the process of enacting laws that are then, you know, passed through the House and Senate and signed by the president And although it's not in the Constitution, in practice over the years, you know, validated or knocked down by the Supreme Court. So, make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure enough. Thanks a lot for the call. Rick in Irwin, Tennessee. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've got a couple things. A while back, I heard you say something about food stamps. I just wanted to tell you the maximum monthly benefit is $200. So that's $666 a day. And also...
Wow, that's got to... You know, I'm surprised. If it's $6.66 a day, that's $666.
Yeah,
I'm surprised that hasn't got, you know, Ralph Reed and his buddies all hysterical. Or maybe it is. Maybe that's their proof that people on food stamps are agents of the devil.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was this stuff about the Republicans trying to disavow these polls.
Right.
What's going on is they're just setting it up for when they steal this damn thing, they'll have an excuse.
Yeah, no, Rick, I totally agree with you. And, in fact, that is going to be the topic of the entire next hour. So, you know, just hang on, and I will get back to you on that. Tom in Evansville, Wisconsin. Hey, Tom. Thanks. You're an attorney.
Yes, I'm an attorney, actually, and a police officer.
Okay.
I am ecstatic that you're talking about this right to privacy. I wanted to mention that this is kind of a shocker, but nowhere in the U.S. Constitution, and of course you read the Fourth Amendment, nowhere did our forefathers explicitly write in a right to privacy.
Well, you know why that is.
Go ahead.
If you go back and, you know, get a dictionary from 1780 and look up the word privacy, and it will tell you that it has to do with toilet functions.
Well, I wondered about that.
No, I'm serious. I'm serious. This is why they were called privies when they first built them. And the way that in polite company, you know, if you were at a dinner table with Thomas Jefferson or with your next door neighbor and you needed to go out to the outhouse and up until, you know, the mid or late 1700s. I mean, Jefferson was one of the first people to actually have toilets inside his house, but they were still outhouses functionally. He just had, you know, servants who emptied them.
Sure.
But, you know, if you wanted to say to the fellow guests or to your host, excuse me, I need to leave the table and go to the bathroom, they didn't call them bathrooms back then. And Thomas Crapper didn't, you know, his device wasn't, you know, the flush toilet didn't come along until the mid 1900s, or the late 1900s. But in the late 1700s, when the Constitution was written, you would say, excuse me, I need a moment of privacy. And everybody understood that that meant you need to go to the bathroom, what you and I today would call the bathroom. It's not even a bathroom.
Right.
It's the toilet. And it's, you know, it's arguably not even that. So that's why the word privacy, you will not find the word privacy in the constitutional debates. You will not find, and I've read them, you will not find it in the Federalist Papers, and I've read them. You will not find it in anywhere in any of Jefferson's writings, and I've got a 20-meg file with everything on it. You can search it. It's just they did not use the word privacy back then because it was code for toilet functions.
So. Well, this is what worries me with our current Supreme Court. The court really went out of its way to talk about these penumbral rights, the rights of the Constitution that aren't actually mentioned by
right.
by word, but, you know, from all of the amendments and the body of the Constitution, you know, the court finds the right. And what, in fact, in Griswold versus Connecticut.
Right. Tom, hang on. I want to bring this back.
Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
It's 46 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with more on privacy after this. Stick around.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Poor people gonna rise up, get their share.
There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Stephanie, am I saying this right? Shriok?
Stephanie Shriok. You got it.
Stephanie Shriok, the president of Emily's List. Emily'sList.org is on the line with us. And Stephanie, one of the reasons I'm so pleased to have you on is I have gotten a number of, we've actually had callers ask this question, and I haven't always had the best answer. In fact, I don't think I've ever had the best answer. But and you know, people on our message board and in our chat room and whatnot, saying, I would like to support progressive organizations. Where do I go? So tell me about Emily's List. This is a progressive organization that is supporting female candidates, women candidates, correct?
That's exactly right. Tell them to go to emilyslist.org. That's the first thing
there you
need
go.
To answer
you
that
go.
Question. Emily's List is an organization that came into being 27 years ago to elect pro-choice Democratic women to office. And before Emily's List started, no Democratic woman had won a seat in the United States Senate in her own right. I mean, it was only 27 years ago.
Wow.
And so since then, we have been training, recruiting strong pro-choice Democratic women candidates to run for the House, for the Senate, for governorships around the country. In the last 10 years, we've done more and more work at the legislative level. We've now supported thousands of women at that level, and we have helped elect 16 women to the United States Senate and 87 to the House of Representatives, and we expect this November to really increase those numbers.
Now, Stephanie, has your portfolio or mandate expanded beyond just reproductive issue, women who are supportive of reproductive issues or you know, choice on abortion and things like that, to just women in general? Because, I mean, there's a huge body of evidence out there that nations, organizations, whatever, that are run by women tend to be, you know, more peaceful, more well organized, less likely to have wars. I mean, you know, it's, I think there's something to be said for the old, my old friend Ned Halliwell, professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School's comment that testosterone is the most dangerous drug on earth.
Well, it's best to have all of this balanced out, right? And when you've said it exactly right. It really does matter to have more and more women at all levels of government and in society, in business and corporations and law firms, you name it. If you have more women sitting at the decision-making tables, you have more progressive policies moving forward. So we have, we have always supported pro-choice Democratic women, really because we felt like we needed to make big moves in the Democratic Party. And of course, for us, I mean, choice is just a basic freedom for women. I mean, that's just at our core, what this needs to be about. And it's reproductive rights, but it's just having opportunities to make decisions in our lives to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
But we've always focused on the Democratic Party because when we started, you know, we needed to make inroads into the party structure. Now the Democratic Party is much more open to having women run, obviously. You saw at the convention an incredible show of our Emily's List women standing up. I mean, from Barbara Mikulski to Elizabeth Warren and Tammy Baldwin, and just on and on. We are so proud of all of them, really leaders of the Democratic Party. But if you looked 30 years ago, that convention would have looked a lot different.
Yeah.
We've made those changes. We've worked hard in the party. I wish that the Republican Party had a similar group of pro-choice women making the same changes in the Republican Party, because right now they are moving very fast backwards, trying to roll the clock back, and I think they would do well to reopen their party to pro-choice Republican women.
Where do Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins stand, the two women the two women who are senators from Maine?
Well, I think Olympia Snowe says it best. I mean, she threw her hands up in the air and said, "Enough with this place."
She's out this year. You're right.
Done. And I'm looking forward to seeing the book that she's coming out with next year to really get a sense of how she's feeling about this. I think it's very, very hard. Emily's List over the summer put together some research on, to that earlier point, how women really make a difference in government and what does it mean to have women. The Impact Project is what we call it. And what we found is Democratic women are more progressive than our Democratic male counterparts across the board on all issues for the last two decades. And what we also found was that Republican women were more progressive than their Republican male counterparts on the same trajectory until the last 4 or 5 years, and those lines on the Republican Party between men and women have come together.
Interesting.
And it's fascinating and concerning to me.
Yeah, it is. When you look at countries like Norway, where about half, a little less than half of their legislature is women, and I believe that's by law, isn't there a 40% threshold by law in Norway?
I believe that's correct.
And Iceland, which has historically been a matrilineal society, if you're named after your mother, if you're a woman, you're Susan's daughter, rather than John's son, that kind of thing. Many of these countries are way ahead of us. I mean, my recollection is we're averaging around 16 or 17% elected representation at the federal level of women.
That's correct. We're at 17% right now. That puts the United States at 77th in the world.
Right. And Rwanda is number one.
Right. Yes, Rwanda is number one. And you look at, I mean, even countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a minimum set there that they have to have a minimum of 25% women in their parliaments. I mean, this is Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
And the reason they have that law is because the United States government demanded it.
Well, not unlike, Truman helping the Germans put themselves back together after World War II and said, you guys ought to have a national health care system.
Right. Very good point. Very good point.
Yeah, what he couldn't get done in America, he got done over there. And any company over 1,000 employees has to have half their board of directors made up of representatives of organized labor. But working to get more women into elective office, frankly, in my opinion, this transcends even the choice issue. This is a war and peace issue. This is a human rights issue. This is a future of the earth issue.
That's right, an economic issue. I mean, you look at some of our candidates that we're supporting this year, Elizabeth Warren being at the top of that list, a leader in consumer protection and economic reforms to move this country forward. Her voice in the United States Senate will absolutely change the direction of this country.
And already has, I would submit.
I agree.
Stephanie, emilyslist.org, Stephanie Schreyack.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick heads up at the end of the hour here. Kristen Cabral is going to be with us, taking our country back, an attorney and mom running for Virginia's 10th district. We'll tell you all about that when we get there. And in the next hour, Senator Sherrod Brown is going to drop by. Always nice to hear from the senator. But I wanted to open this hour by asking a question that it genuinely has me scratching my head. We know that, for example, in the 2000 election, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush conspiring to throw 50, 60, 80,000, you know, the numbers are still being debated, African-Americans off the voting rolls in Florida before the election even began. Some 60, 70, 80,000 people, African-Americans largely, showed up to vote, were told, sorry, I don't see your name on the list here. Here's a provisional ballot. Fill this out. And those never got counted. Or if they did get counted, they compared it to the list and their names weren't on the list. So they got thrown away. And that put the election within stealing distance by George W. Bush. Now, when the final count, of course, for the whole state got counted, it showed that Al Gore actually had the most votes in Florida. But that was a whole year after the election. And the Supreme Court, in stopping the statewide recount that had been ordered by the Florida Supreme Court and ignoring the 10th Amendment, states' rights, all that other stuff, ruled that complainant George W. Bush would, in fact, be irreparably harmed if the count was allowed to continue forward. In other words, he would lose the election. It's right there in Bush v. Gore. You can read it. This is not rocket science. So, you know, basically what they did was they got it. They got the vote within the margin of error so that they could steal the election. Well, right now, increasingly, the polls are showing there's no margin of error. I mean, you go over to Intrade.com, you know, the Irish betting site. I've been watching this for weeks. It's amazing. Right now, this very moment, as we speak, 75.8% chance Obama's going to win. 24.5% chance Romney's going to win. Now, that's professional bettors all over the world. They're looking at the numbers. And they're looking at numbers like you can see over at the New York Times today. They've got an interactive graphic. And this is all the swing states, including Colorado, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Wisconsin. In Florida, Obama is up 53 to 44. In Ohio, he's up 53 to 43 over Romney. In Pennsylvania, he's beating Romney 54 to 42. It's a 12-point swing in Pennsylvania. In Wisconsin, 51 to 45. That's Paul Ryan's home state. I mean, there's doubts that Paul Ryan's going to hang onto his own seat, although he has spent 10 times more than his Democratic challenger. In Colorado, Obama 48, Romney 47. In Virginia, 50% Obama, 46% Romney. And then when they get into who's better on the issues, Obama's just wiping out Romney. You know, who do you think would do a better job on national security? Obama beats Romney every single one. On those states that I just listed, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Colorado, Virginia, 52, 53, 53, 50, 48, 51%. In every case, beating Romney. Regardless of how you intend to vote, who do you think is going to do a better job on the economy? Obama beats Romney in every case. Who do you think is going to do a better job on the budget deficit? With the exception of Wisconsin, Obama beats Romney in all of them. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm wrong on that. I'm sorry. In Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, actually, on the budget deficit, Romney's beating Obama in four of those states. Well, that makes sense. So, I mean, Romney just constantly talks about the budget deficit. Healthcare, again, Obama's beating. But you go over to the Drudge Report, drudgereport.com, and what's the headline? Poll, Obama 46, Romney 46. Now, this is completely inconsistent. And by the way, in the upper left-hand corner, they got violent protests swirl in Spain. Greek protests turn violent. Apparently, they haven't, like, put the two and two together that in Spain and Greece, they're doing what Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan want to do to America. They're doing austerity. And it's not working, and people are out. But setting that aside, why is it that the right-wing websites, the hard right websites, the ones that that carry the water for the Republican Party and for the hard right wingers, the ones that are always, you know, enthusiastic about a new war and all that kind of thing, why is it that they're all saying that this race is a dead heat, when in fact nobody in their right mind is saying it's a dead heat? Could it be that it's only a dead heat, A, if you include all of the voter suppression that's going to go on? I mean, this is some of the stuff from theweek.com, some of the right-wing stuff. GOP skeptics say Romney's doing better than surveys suggest. People conducting polls are interviewing too many Democrats. These are their talking points. Pollsters are choosing their sample size based on the assumption that 2012 will be similar to 2008. In other words, now this is a real cruncher one. Dick Morris is talking about this. Keep in mind, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Paul Wavrick's organization, the guy who said, I don't want everybody to vote back in 1980, the American Legislative Exchange Council has passed all these laws or gotten all these laws, particularly in the swing states, saying that it's much harder for you to vote. You got to get ID. And who are the people who don't have ID? Elderly people. They're no longer driving. They can't get out. They don't have ID. Current ID. Expired ID doesn't work, by the way. Which doesn't make any sense to me. Hey, I'm still me. Right? This is my passport. It expired last week, but I'm still me. No, it doesn't count. Okay. So anyhow, they don't have current ID. Elderly people. Students 18 to 24. 25% of them don't have driver's licenses, current ID. African-Americans, 24% of them nationwide. Latinos, 23% nationwide. So basically, elderly people, students, African-Americans, and urban dwellers, but largely African-Americans, and Hispanics don't have. So these are the people who turned out in big numbers for Obama in 2008. And here's Dick Morris saying, they're not going to turn out in big numbers this time. And I have to ask myself, why? And the only answer I can come up with is these voter suppression ID laws. Here's Dick Morris on Fox News.
Well, I don't think the numbers are accurate. I think that there is a fundamental error going on in the polling this year by the media organizations, not by Scott Rasmussen. These pollsters are using the 2008 turnout model that was a totally unique turnout. Huge African-American, huge Latino, huge college students, relatively fewer elderly. And that model happened for 1 year only, 2008. It didn't happen in 10, it didn't happen in 4, it didn't happen in 00. and they're wrong for applying it. It is true that if the same people vote in 12 as voted in 8, Obama's going to get reelected, but it's not going to happen.
Right. It's not going to happen. I mean, we've got our voter suppression laws. This reminds me of Congressman Peter King talking to Alexandra Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's daughter, who did this documentary on the 2004 election. And Peter King, predicting that George Bush was going to beat John Kerry, was fairly drunk. He was standing out in this party, and he had a beer in his hand. You watch, it's in the documentary. And, you know, the voting's going on, and here's what he had to say.
It's already over. The election's over. We won.
How do you know that?
It's all over but the counting. We'll take care of the counting.
It's all over but the counting, and we'll take care of the counting. Well, and that's what they did in 2004. They took care of the counting in Ohio and probably a number of other states. It's called redshift. It's where the polls show that, you know, the race is coming out a particular way, but the electronic voting machines show that the Republicans are 5 points ahead of what the polls show. And only in some states. So that was their big, you know, game changer in 2004. Is their big game changer in 2012, as you could infer, arguably, from Dick Morris's comment, that ain't going to happen? That they're going to keep those groups of people that Dick Morris named from voting?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And is that why all this right-wing media is talking about, hey, you know, they're measuring the wrong people, they shouldn't be counting those people? Well, because why? Because we're going to keep them from voting. Find the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, let me just lay this out a little more. I mean, I'll just read you some headlines. Okay, The Atlantic, of all places. Are polls skewed too heavily against Republicans? Well, here's the subhead: probably not. As the chorus of complaints in the right wing grows louder, pollsters say there are simply more people who identify as Democrats. National Journal. Republicans to pollsters, too many Democrats in your survey. That's a right-wing publication. Investors.com, Republicans are right, fact-checkers wrong. Right. In this case, on welfare. Breitbart.com, era of media fact-checkers intimidating Republicans is over. Right. The fact-checkers are intimidating the Republicans. Yeah. Facts are scary things for Republicans. It's just on and on it goes, right? The latest attempt by Democrats to refute a charge, this is from Obama from investors.com, to refute a charge that has become a huge headache for them because, well, it's true. This is Paul Ryan's RNC speech. The era of media fact checkers intimidating Republicans is over. Lying, disgraceful media fact checker dutifully follows suit with a flurry of lying, disgrace checking of Ryan. I'm sorry, this is from Breitbart.com, not from the RNC speech. It's about the Ryan RNC speech. Breitbart.com writing, this was undoubtedly pre-planned and organized between Team Obama and his media. Right, all the media is in the bag for Obama, don't you know? The Week. GOP skeptics say Romney is doing better than surveys suggest. You know, it goes on and on and on. So there is this siege mentality, and it's not, and it even goes beyond that. There's this massive conspiracy theory, you know, worthy of how conspiracy theories just take root and grow in so many third world countries around the world. There is this conspiracy theory on the right that the polls are all wrong and Mitt Romney's doing just wonderful. Paul Ryan is beloved. Everybody thinks his plan, they don't know what it is, everybody thinks his plan is wonderful. His plan for what? Healthcare? Oh, yeah, emergency rooms. Yeah, that's wonderful. His plan for what? Taxes? Oh, yeah, cut taxes on the rich, raise taxes on working people. Oh, that's wonderful. I don't think so. His plan for Medicare? Yeah, let's get some vouchers in here. Throw grandma off the cliff. Well, it's not grandma, it's you, when you become grandma. So is this a strategy? I mean, this is a serious question. I mean, you know, Limbaugh went off on this at some length yesterday. Well, here it is, clip number two. Listen to this.
I don't believe a poll that shows Obama up 7 or 8 with a plus 13 Democrat samples. I just throw it out. Other polls, I have had a tendency, if they don't reflect what I sense is going on, or what I hope is going on, I disregard them.
Yeah, this is the traditional Republican way. Oh, we don't like that science that says the Earth is warming as carbon dioxide goes up. We'll ignore it. Jim Inhofe, the guy who, if the Republicans take the Senate, is going to be the head of the Senate Environmental Committee. It's a hoax, don't you know? Right. Right, seriously? Todd Akin? Oh, women who are legitimately raped, their bodies produce magic substances that prevent pregnancy. Didn't you know that? Right. Newt Gingrich is out helping him try to win the election right now. Sad. In any case, there is this conspiracy theory that the polling is being reported the way it is, unfactually, not factually, in order to suppress the Republican vote. Again, here's Limbaugh.
Emotional roller coasters tend to emphasize the lows, tend to be more affected by the low, by the dip in an emotional roller coaster than you are with at the peak. And I think that's all part of the game to suppress our turnout and
right.
to suppress our vote.
Right. Yeah, it's all there to suppress and depress the turnout in the Republic. Maybe, Rush, it's reality. You think? But here's the question. Let me give you the left-wing conspiracy theory on this. The left-wing conspiracy theory is that the reason all the right-wing websites and all the right-wing pundits are saying, no, this race is 50-50, and Romney is even ahead in some places. The reason they're saying that is because they know that they have succeeded already in throwing somewhere between 5 and 10 million people off the voting rolls. And in states like Florida, where it's virtually a crime to register somebody to vote, I mean, only a couple thousand Democrats have been registered to vote this election year, whereas, you know, 4 years ago it was hundreds of thousands, over 100,000. That they're going to be so successful in these modern-day Jim Crow attempts to keep older people, African-Americans, students, Latinos from voting, they're going to be so successful at that they're going to win. And after they win, after Romney wins and Republicans win in the House and Senate or whatever it may be, they're going to say, see, we told you so. And if people say, no, wait a minute, this has got to be fraud, they could say, oh, no, here's 50 headlines from news reports back in September telling you this was coming. And the media will go, oh, well, yeah, okay, let's have a balanced discussion like NPR did the other day where they had a climatologist saying, oh, there's no such thing as climate change, and an actual climate scientist on saying, huh, are you nuts? So it's like this phony balance, right? It will repeat itself. So are the Republicans pushing this line because they've got the theft in the bag? Are they pushing this line because they've got an October surprise coming? Was what happened in Benghazi an October surprise? I don't know. Or is it just that they can't deal with reality?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, there's plenty of precedent for they can't deal with reality. A majority of Republicans, registered Republicans, don't believe Obama was born in this country and do think that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's our cheesy news alert. Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Reporting that GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney finally got some good news today as he found himself ahead of President Obama in a poll of NFL replacement referees. The survey, which immediately lifted the spirits of the Romney campaign, was taken among replacement refs on the field during NFL games that they were supposed to be officiating last Sunday and Monday. According to the poll, if the election were held today, the replacement refs would have Mr. Romney beating President Obama by a score of 14 to 12. Excuse me. By a wide majority, though, the replacement refs strongly agree with the statement, "I'm pretty sure I'm right about this, but I need to talk it over with some other people first." Brilliant. Brilliant. So why are these polls so skewed? By the way, a great story over at crooksandliars.com. Let's see, who wrote this blog? I give credit where credit's due. Susie Madrak. She says, "I wonder when New Jersey voters are going to realize Governor Chris Christie is really not all that charming. Witness this exchange with a reporter," and there's a clip there of, you know, basically him telling a reporter to blow it off. But here's the question that was laid out. This is a report by WABC's Jim Hoffer. 2 years ago, New Jersey received $300 million. Remember, pardon my interrupting myself, but remember on 60 Minutes where Steve Croft or Scott Pelley, I forget who was interviewing whom, but the guy who was interviewing Obama said, "You know, you had that plan to help people out with their mortgages. The banks got bailed out, but the people with their mortgages didn't get bailed out." And he said it in a very accusatory way, and Obama kind of, "Well, you know, we recalibrated that. We tried to do it better." The fact of the matter is, though, that the Obama administration passed out a lot of the money to the states, and they did it the way that Romney wants to do Medicaid now, in block grants. Right? So here's a pile of money. Use it to help your struggling homeowners. And because it was a block grant, the states didn't have to use it for that. They could use it for whatever they wanted. So, you know, Scott Walker used it to balance his budget. To hell with homeowners in Wisconsin. Well, same thing happened in New Jersey. Here's the quote from WABC's report. 2 years ago, New Jersey received $300 million from the federal government to help the unemployed from losing their homes. The state used the money to create the Homekeeper Loan Program. Data Eyewitness News obtained show that since 2010, Homekeeper has only approved 498 families for foreclosure assistance. In fact, less than $4 million of the $300 million has been spent. So what these states are doing is they're dropping their money into the general fund so it doesn't show a deficit so that they can campaign on or they can claim that they have a balanced budget. In the case of New Jersey, they were given $300 million. They gave $4 million of it to 498 homeowners and took $296 million of it, presumably, and said, "Oh, look at that. Our budget is balanced now." This is mind-boggling. So, I mean, you know, with that kind of stuff going on, but it's not by and large being reported on. Most Americans don't know it. I mean, they don't know it so much so that when one of the big news guys on 60 Minutes basically attacks the president on it, he doesn't even know it. Right? I mean, why wasn't his question, you know, in particular the Republican states, although it's not just Republican states, but in particular the Republican states took all that money, that billions of dollars that Congress appropriated that you passed out to the states to help struggling homeowners. In particular, in the Republican states, they simply kept that money and used it to say, "Hey, our budget's balanced. I'm going to run on a balanced budget. Thank you, Mr. Obama, for that free money." Homeowners? We got no homeowners in this state. Struggling homeowners? Nah. You know, I went out to the white suburbs the other day and I just asked around and I didn't find that many. You know, it was the McMansion era. Actually, this is hitting the McMansions as well. I'm not sure how they would spin this. So, anyhow, the question is, you know, is the fix in, and is that why the Republicans are pushing so hard on these polls? Sonia in Oakland, California. Hey, Sonia, what's up?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a three-part question. I don't know how Obama's going to win, even if all these people want to vote for him. And, of course, I've never voted Republican. But here's my assessment.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, they have all this money, billions, okay? And what I would do if I were the strategist running all this, I would put a lot of that money into the House of Reps races so that it was still in the control of Republicans.
They're doing that. They're doing that.
Even if Obama gets elected, he won't be able to do anything budget-wise.
Yeah,
and then, two, if they can't keep these people without all the voter registrations going on, and I certainly think they can keep millions out that way, that could throw the election. And there's the third part. I don't think these states have gotten rid of those computers that have no paper backup.
Yeah, there's 12 states that have no paper whatsoever. That's entirely touchscreen machines.
Right.
And then the rest of the nation, and this was all the result of the Help America Vote Act that was pushed through Congress by George W. Bush in 2002 that passed out, as I recall, $5.6 billion, minor number of billions of dollars. As block grants to the states, or as grants to the states, to buy machines from Diebold, ES&S, whatever. And, those voting machines are now in every state in the union.
So how can he win?
Well, it's a damn good question. And I think that the way he won in 2008, I was having this conversation, I believe it was Jeff Cohen, the founder of FAIR, the other day, although I could be wrong, but I was having this conversation with somebody who follows this stuff very closely.
Slaughter a lamb or something.
Yeah, last week.
And
what he said was, in the 2008 election, we're guessing that they stole probably 4 or 5 million votes, but we showed up, an extra 5 or 6 million votes. And so, we were able to overcome that. And I think that, I think, Sonia, that that's what we have to do. Thank you for the call. I just don't see an alternative. We've got to get people out there and say, we're going to overwhelm them. We have no other choice. Marcia in Margate, Florida, listening on the KPOJ stream. Hey, Marcia, what's up?
Oh, I'm just calling to say that I think we might be making some headways as far as voter suppression. In today's Sun Sentinel, there was names and addresses in the paper stating that people who were being discriminated against, they, at least I can see their name in the paper, and go to the Broward voting office and take and do the steps that they need to do to get on the registration again.
Well, that's interesting. So they're publishing the names of people who are alleged to be non-citizen,
are knocked off the voter registration rolls.
Okay, so they're publishing the names of and addresses of people who have been knocked off the voter registration rolls. Are these people who have protested?
I don't know. I just noticed it when I was reading the paper today that their names and addresses were listed. And there was quite a bit. I didn't count the amount of people, but
sure,
there were quite a few people that were listed, so which is good. So, we had people here in Coconut Creek and Coral Springs and other cities around that were listed, so at least they'll be able to go forward with, taking the right steps to take.
For a real voter, it's going to be a real shock when they get a call from their next-door neighbor saying, hey, I saw your name in the paper. If there are any illegal voters on there, any people contemplating voter fraud, I'm guessing that will be national news. If they can find, Florida has found one guy so far, that Austrian guy who became a Canadian citizen and then lied and said he was a U.S. citizen so he could buy guns down in Florida, and he voted in the 2004 and 2008 elections.
What I found kind of strange is that none of them sounded like foreign names. They were almost like a common name. So.
Right.
They weren't going after the, the illegals. And also, down here, we don't get any progressive talk radio at all. We only get Randy Rhodes for 2 hours, and that's it in Broward County.
Wow.
We don't get any other. The only way I get you is on my computer.
Yeah, I saw you're listening to the AM 620 KPOJ Portland, Oregon stream. Marcia, thank you very much for listening, and thanks for the call, and thanks for your comments. I think you're right on. Carla in Pueblo, Colorado. Hey, Carla, what's up?
Well, I want to say that I am a very proud member of Free Speech TV.
Great. Good
on
you.
My question is, why can't President Obama do an executive decision on these voter laws?
Because he would be overriding state legislatures, which would be loudly and probably appropriately condemned as a violation of the 10th Amendment, the executive branch unilaterally telling the states what to do. He doesn't have that power under the Constitution.
He does not.
No.
Okie dokie.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It would be nice if he could simply say, sorry, not going to be able to get away with that. Jerry in Long Island, listening to WWRL. Got a minute to the break. Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. Except for Florida, where I do think voter suppression for these new voter ID laws may be used to disenfranchise people, I think otherwise in most of these other states, for the most part, if Republican election theft does occur, it will be due to the particular kind of electronic touchscreen voting machines with no paper trail that you were discussing with a previous caller in key swing states such as Ohio and Wisconsin. Yeah. They have these kind of
This is how Bob Riley and Karl Rove, stole the Alabama governorship from Don Siegelman. You know, in the middle of the night, after Don Siegelman had been declared the winner, they suddenly found a bunch of votes in one Republican precinct after the Democratic poll watchers had left, like at midnight or something. And by the way, go over to donsiegelman.org for more information on that and to sign the petition to have President Obama pardon Don Siegelman, America's one of several, but America's most prominent political.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Why do you think that the right-wing media is so convinced that Romney's way ahead after everything that's happened?
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't.
Yes, we're taking our country back one congressional district at a time. I mean, literally, from the White House down to the local dog catcher's office, we need to be taking our country back. Kristen Cabral is with us on the line. Am I pronouncing that right, Kristen?
Yes, Tom. It's Kristen Cabral.
Great.
You can find my website at kristencabral.com.
Great. And that's KristinCabral.com. And
yes, sir.
You are running for Virginia's 10th district to unseat Republican Congressman Frank Wolf of Virginia, who has been in Congress for 32 years. Do I have this right?
That's right. He came in 1980 and has been there ever since.
Wow. He came in as part of it was a relatively minor Reagan sweep, actually, that year. But he came in with Reagan. The fellow who runs our video here is familiar with Virginia politics, and he was of the opinion that Frank Wolf had made a commitment when he first came in that he would only serve a certain number of terms. Do you know about that?
I do. I've heard since I've been out on the trail that when he ran in 1980, he made a promise to the voters to serve, I think it was up to three terms. So he has a self-imposed shelf life of 1986, but yet he's still there.
Yeah.
He broke his promise to the voters when it came to his belief in term limits.
Yeah, okay. So we're talking with Kristen Cabral, KristinCabral.com is her website. She's running for the Democrat, running for the 10th District of Virginia, running for the House of Representatives, an attorney, and a mom. Kristen, tell us about yourself and about your platform.
Sure. My name is Kristen Cabral. I am a wife, mother, worker, and volunteer. I am the first woman in my family to go to college. I was one of the first children to graduate from Head Start. I graduated in 1971 from Head Start.
Wow, good idea.
My grandpas were ninth grade dropouts. One was a union truck driver, the other one a factory foreman. And my mom and grandmas, so blessedly still alive at ages 97, 91, and 69, were high school diploma secretaries in offices and schools. Now, from this working class background, I was self-motivated to do better economically by putting myself through college and Harvard Law School, actually the same class as President Obama.
Wow.
So I ended up cobbling together, like so many right now, students looking to grab onto those educational opportunities that will get them those good job opportunities. I cobbled together those Pell Grants, government-backed student loans, work-study jobs. During the time you're a student, you do on campus in between hitting the books. And I also work part-time jobs like McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
And also I had some scholarship money, too, when I started getting good grades. So when it comes to education, I actually cannot say I built it alone. But rather, we built it.
There you go.
Together, thanks to the investment the taxpayer made in me.
Uh-huh.
I paid back those student loans with interest and slightly ahead of schedule. But as to my platform, I'm looking to bring fresh leadership to our broken Congress in order to ensure that we preserve and grow the American dream. My own story shows it the best. We do this through opportunity, both through educational and job opportunities.
Now, the American dream is something that is much in debate these days and has been largely since Reagan. I'd say prior to Reagan's presidency, there was an absolute consensus going all the way back to 1862 when Lincoln gave out western lands to anybody who wanted to go settle them, that the American dream was that, you know, if you work hard and keep your nose clean, you can have a decent middle class life or some approximation thereof. Reagan then, you know, since the Reagan Revolution, American dream has been recalibrated to you too can get as rich as Mitt Romney. I'm curious what you mean when you say the American dream that you're trying to help bring back to the United States or make available to more people through your candidacy, Kristen Cabral.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Tom, because, again, preserving and growing that American dream is so important, especially for my children. And I happen to have two young teenagers who are 13 and 15, and the coming generations. As I said, my platform is to provide opportunity, and we do this through our self-government. I'm a big believer in participatory democracy, and this is going to be part of what I'll do in the Congress.
Right.
So, for instance, for educational opportunities, we need to make sure we have that Head Start that I so benefited from. So I went from Head Start to Harvard Law School.
Right.
Make sure our young people and even those looking to finish their educations, higher educations, or retrain, have access to college and technical training. And that means investments, and that means growing our community college system, our technical education, making sure we have those Pell Grants, low-interest student loans backed by the government, work-study jobs. And that also will bring us to the next thing that's so important about my platform on opportunity, and that is the job opportunity. So once you've gotten that good education, put your nose to the grindstone, worked hard, you'll have job opportunities by which to earn a paycheck in order to keep the roof over your head, food in the kid's mouth, and clothes on your back.
And have the American dream.
That's the American dream. That's right. So we're going to take back the country, the American dream, and the very first bill that I plan to drop and submit there at the Congress is to boost support for the Office of Women Business Ownership, which is part of the Small Business Administration, already part of our self-government. And what that bill will provide is to make sure women have a better business training, access to credit, and marketing opportunities.
That is marvelous. Kristen Cabral, Kristen Cabral, KristinCabral.com is the website. Check it out. Kristen, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much. And let's go.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Sherrod Brown is going to be with us a little later in the hour. A lot going on. I'm still wondering what's the deal with the Republicans, not the Republicans, the right-wingers, being convinced that that Romney tanking in the polls isn't happening. I mean, isn't it fairly clear that he has no plan for America? He has no plan for our economy. He's going to close loopholes so that he can drop taxes on really rich people. He wants to take the top tax rate from 36% down to 25%, and the way he's going to pay for that is close loopholes. Now, what loopholes are he going to close? most commonly used loopholes in the United States are the child tax deduction and the mortgage tax deduction. I mean, it accounts for billions of dollars, probably hundreds of billions of dollars. It's a lot of money. And he won't say that that's not what he intends to do away with. And in fact, when you do the numbers on Romney's, you know, if he's actually going to cut those top tax rates as much as he says he is, then he's going to have to do away with those. I mean, any attempt to do them, and even then you don't come out with a balanced budget. There is no math that makes his plan work. Just like there's no math that makes Paul Ryan's plan work. Paul Ryan was lionized as the great intellectual giant of the Republican Party. The author of the budget bill that passed the House of Representatives twice, all Republicans voting for it. The budget bill made no sense. Other than voucherizing Medicare, I mean, it basically, and then that makes no sense. But even that isn't going to help or save Medicare. It's going to destroy Medicare over time. Just like voucherizing schools will destroy our public education system over time. This isn't rocket science. You could do the math on this. I don't care how many fluffy, you know, nice, sweet little interviews you get in the national media or how many cool movies co-sponsored by the Bill Gates Foundation you can come up with. Bottom line is you voucherize Medicare, you destroy Medicare. You voucherize public education, you're going to destroy our public school system. At least for poor people, and with regard to Medicare, at least for the people who really need it. So in any case, given how incompetent and messed up, and I mean, Mitt Romney saying he doesn't, it's not his job to represent 47% of Americans. I mean, some of the, and then he doubles down on it by saying, well, I was inelegant in the way I said it. Rachel Maddow did this so hysterically. She put a monocle on it and said, oh, you're supposed to say it with a monocle? Yes, right. Elegantly. How do you say that elegantly? That 47% of Americans are moochers because they happen to be on Social Security or they make, you know, $25,000-$30,000 a year and therefore they make so little that they live below the poverty line and they don't pay federal income taxes. Or $10,000 or $15,000 a year. How do you say that elegantly? Or they're disabled, and they're living on Social Security disability income. 1/3 of all Social Security payments, by the way. Young people, widows, orphans, injured people, bad, severely injured people. How do you say that those people are moochers in a way that's elegant? Apparently in Republican land, there's a way to do it. I haven't heard a good example of it, but apparently it's there. And so somehow the right-wing echo chamber, from Fox so-called News to the right-wing talk show hosts to the right-wing blogosphere and the right-wing websites and Drudge, another right-wing website, somehow all of them have come up with the collective belief that Romney's at least at parity in the polls, perhaps even ahead in the polls, that he might win, and that if he loses, it's because a bunch of brown-skinned people, probably most of them illegal immigrants, Hispanics, committed voter fraud and showed up and voted when they aren't actually U.S. citizens, something that happens maybe 20 or 30 times a year nationwide, if that. And in fact, most of the people who do that are not Hispanics who show up who are not Americans. People would be crazy to do that. It's like, hey, ICE, come and get me. No, typically voter fraud, when it is caught and prosecuted, the most common form of it, the most common form, and again, it's, you know, 20, 30 times a year nationwide. It's the about half of the states that say that if you go to jail at any point in your life for a felony, you lose your right to vote forever, which I think is stupid. I think if you've repaid your debts to society and you're going to reintegrate yourself back into society and get a job and get married and raise a family or whatever it may be, you know, whatever the whatever the goal is of this, you know, kind of normalizing people's lives, that being able to vote should be part of it. Hey, you've paid your debt to society. Thank you very much. You're no longer on parole. You're no longer in jail. You can now vote. That's how it is in about half the states. About half the states, they say, no, you can't vote, ever. So most voter fraud, and again, it's 20, 30 people a year, are people who are felons who live in states where felons aren't allowed to vote, and they don't realize it. Now, typically, felons are informed of this by their parole officers, their probation officers, whatever, because the last thing that somebody who just got out of prison wants to do is go back to prison, and voting illegally will cause you to go back to prison, which is why it happens so rarely. It's like undocumented workers, undocumented aliens, they don't show up at the polls. That's like saying, hey, ICE, come and get me. Felons in states where it's illegal for a felon to vote, they don't show up at the polls because it's like, yes, yeah, send me back to jail, please. But the right wing has developed this whole theory that, oh, it's those brown people and they're going to illegally vote. And the felons, let's not forget the felons and you know, the moochers. Who are the moochers? Oh, yeah, those people who earn tens of millions of dollars and only pay 14% in income taxes. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's not the moochers. I'm sorry. That's the job creators. The moochers. Oh, yeah, those people who are working three jobs at minimum wage and are making so little that they qualify for food stamps and they're not paying federal income taxes. Yeah, those moochers. Somehow they're going to steal the election. And so we've got to knock 5 or 10 million of them off the voting rolls to keep the integrity of the voting rolls safe. Just like back in the day, you know, we had to make sure that they could pass a literacy test. And they could give us the names of at least three participants in the French Parliament after the French Revolution. Or what was Robespierre's first name? It was Maximilian, by the way. But, you know, even most white people don't know that. They don't even know who he was. Or, you know, if a triangle has a 90-degree angle in it, what kind of triangle is that? It's isosceles, isn't it, Shano? Yeah. Well, you know, not everybody studied geometry. And very often the questions were much more complicated than that. I mean, you know, really complex. Like, you know, please list pi to 12 digits. Sorry, I couldn't pass that literacy test. I remember 3.14125916. Oh, you 1415916. Okay, you've got to memorize farther than I used to know it till like 10 or 12, but I don't. In any case, this voter suppression has a long history in the United States. It's just that we thought we'd gotten rid of it in the 1960s. It's back. Is that what they're relying on? Really?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Or are they setting up, you know, if Obama wins, another 4 years of, well, he's not legitimate, so therefore we're going to filibuster everything. Yes, Ohio is in play, and one of the guys who's really helping it make Ohio in play is one of the most progressive members of the United States Senate, one of the best members, one of the best senators we have, we, the people of the United States, have representing all of us. And, of course, those of you listening in Ohio know that he especially represents you, Sherrod Brown. Senator Sherrod Brown, his website, Sherrod, S-H-E-R-R-O-D, Brown, B-R-O-W-N, .com is his website. Senator Brown, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here. Thanks. You're one of the best radio guys in the country. All right.
Well, bless you. Thank you. I understand.
I'm not just blowing smoke here, but you know, you bring in a historical perspective that most people don't. I remember one time I was on, you mentioned a letter between Dwight Eisenhower and his brother, and you bring in things that are really important to understand the context of, you know, knowing how the insurance companies and the right wing fought against the creation of Medicare, or fought against the creation of Social Security tells us so much about what they're doing now. They've never liked this stuff. And
yeah,
you bring that in, and that's really important. So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. And in fact, yeah, in that letter, Eisenhower did call out the Hunt brothers and H.L. Hunt specifically by name and the other oil millionaires in Texas whose number was small and they were stupid. Senator Brown, I understand that there's a new Crossroad GPS ad that has rolled out in Ohio. This has pushed the outside spending to over $19.6 million, coming up on $20 million in outside spending. And I'm just curious, increasingly, I mean, I live here in D.C., and so we get the over-the-air television that comes out of Virginia, which is considered a swing state, and so we're just constantly barraged with all these political ads. And so many of them end with this ad brought to you by Crossroads or Crossroads GPS or whatever it is. And it seems to me, mentally, as soon as I hear that, I just go, Karl Rove, it's a lie. And I'm wondering if you're getting that kind of feedback, not necessarily just to pick on Karl Rove, but if you're getting that kind of feedback that all of this, you know, almost $20 million worth of negative ads against you are starting to not just wear on people, but cause people to say, damn it, I don't want to hear any more of this nonsense.
Yeah, I think it's doing a couple things. First, I think when people see a whole lot of money coming in against one person and they don't really know who the groups are, or what the Concerned Women of America or Crossroads or 60 Plus or groups like that, I think they start thinking, where's all this money coming from? Who are these people and why are they doing this?
Right.
And that's an important step in a democracy, because then they're thinking, well, if this guy stands up to the oil companies or this guy stands up to Wall Street, he's somebody we want to vote for. And I think the public's starting to see that. And the part about lying, I mean, this crowd, I mean, my opponent is a sort of a Karl Rove understudy. Rove's a mentor to him. And they have sort of the same ethics. And they don't really think it matters what FactCheck or PolitiFact.org says, or those groups that are nonpartisan and rate truth and falseness. They have something called pants on fire for those that kind of lie the most, most willful lie, if you will. And what happens then is, I mean, my guy's gotten more, he's gotten more pants on fire than any Senate candidate in the country.
Really?
And he doesn't seem to care. Yeah, he's gotten something like 9 or 10 false or pants on fire. And the voters over time figure that out. I mean, voters aren't reading newspapers enough, perhaps, but they're figuring this out. And we're helping them figure it out because we want to know this guy doesn't have much proclivity to tell the truth. And that's, we use our website for that. We use some TV advertisements for that. Our friends talk about it and our organization talks about it.
Well, you know, this is, you said you like history. Let me just share this with you very quickly here. This is Franklin Delano Roosevelt from the election of 1944. He said that the Republicans were borrowing a technique from Europe, and he just lays this out. And it sounds like the same thing is happening to you in Ohio. Here he is. It's just a 20-second clip. Here he is.
Remember, a number of years ago, there was a book.
A book.
Mein Kampf.
Mein Kampf.
Written by Hitler himself.
Hitler himself.
The technique was all set out in Hitler's book. And it was copied by the aggressors of Italy and Japan. According to that technique, you should never use a small falsehood.
Never use a small falsehood.
Always a big one.
Always a big one.
For its very fantastic nature would make it more credible. If only you keep repeating it over and over and over again.
And then the clip goes on where he goes off on the Republicans for doing that in the race. It sound, you know, with, let's strip Hitler out of this, because the old saying, you know, whoever mentions Hitler loses. Although FDR certainly had the right to. how do you stand up to ads that are pants on fire ads that have lies in them?
Well, sometimes you point it out. I mean, you pointed out perhaps an ad. There's been three newspapers in Ohio that have. It's written about this a good bit. All three, none of the three endorsed me in my 2006 race. One is perhaps the most conservative paper in the state, the Columbus Dispatch, and they have said this campaign, that's what this campaign's all about. It's about not telling the truth. It's about distortion. One newspaper said, how low can Mandel go, and that was a newspaper again that endorsed me this week, but endorsed my opponent 6 years ago. So it's not some Trotskyite paper that's writing this. It's a very much a mainstream paper, and they're pointing that out. And I think the voters, the voters are sometimes just a little suspicious about all the things that these people are saying, and I think that the time's catching up with them. I think that's why you're seeing polls start to look a little better.
Yeah, well, and certainly they should. We're talking with Senator Sherrod Brown, sherrodbrown.com, the website. If you want to find out what's going on with his race or participate in it. Senator Brown, we have a few seconds left. What do you see as the biggest issues of this race?
Biggest issues are who's going to keep the economy going. And we've seen Ohio's unemployment rate go from 10.5% to 10 years ago unemployment to under 7.5% now. And we've seen with the Auto Rescue and Trade Enforcement Recovery Act move in the right direction. And it's the stark contrast. You go back with sort of to the Romney-Bush trickle-down, and the voters are going to reject trickle-down and understand that it's Clinton, Obama, focus on the middle class and grow from there. And that's the whole story in many ways.
I think you've got it nailed. Senator Sherrod Brown, sherrodbrown.com. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, my friend.
I wish you the very best. Good luck on this race.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with your thoughts on why the Republicans are so convinced that the Democrats are actually losing. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very autolophagously ugly. That is a noun, one who eats her words. The good, Russia. On Monday, a French study revealed the bioagriculture giant Monsanto's corn promoted the growth of tumors and caused organ damage in rats and also contained traces of weed killer. After hearing about that study, the Russian government decided to suspend the import and use of American genetically modified corn. Analysts are now saying that this move by Russia may promote other nations to stop importing American genetically modified foods, too. However, most of Europe has already banned genetically modified foods. No one should be eating food, in my humble opinion, that can cause cancer and organ damage. Kudos to Russia for realizing that. Now, if only the U.S. government could come to the same conclusion. The bad. Mecklenburg County, Virginia Republican Party. The party recently posted a picture of President Obama on their Facebook page with him dressed like an Indian witch doctor. But the group's intolerance and ignorance didn't stop there. Not even an Indian witch doctor, an Aboriginal witch doctor. Under the picture of Obama is the text, Obamacare. Coming soon to a clinic near you, with the C in care being represented by a hammer and sickle logo of socialism. As Americans, we are able to enjoy the right to free speech. However, sometimes that right is abused as people and groups use ignorance and hatred to spread their messages. This is one of those times. And images and messages like these, while legal, have frankly no place in 21st century America. And the very, very ugly Jack Armstrong. Armstrong is a radio host, shock jock in San Francisco, and yesterday he urged his listeners to find and create negative depictions of the Prophet Muhammad and paste them on Al Jazeera's website. Armstrong said the ads would help Muslims who riot against such depictions to grow up. Clearly, Armstrong was hiding under a rock 2 weeks ago, didn't see the Middle East erupt in violence over an anti-Muslim film and over hatred of the West. We need to be working to calm the storm in the Middle East and easing tensions between the Muslim people in the United States and other Western nations. What we don't need to be doing is slandering the Prophet Muhammad because of the growing levels of Islamophobia in this country. And that is very, very ugly.
It's bizarrely ugly. I mean, it's incredibly ugly.
Nate in Lakewood, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Nate, what's on your mind? Nate? Whoop. Oh, my fault. Sorry, Nate. I thought I'd push the button, and I hadn't. There you go. You're on the air now.
Hey, I'm here.
You are?
I'll try to say this elegantly.
You put on your monocle?
On this polling thing, in my opinion, when Bush was elected the first time, that was the first time in American history where the exit polls, I believe, did not match the actual results.
In a substantial way in a presidential election, yes. In 98, in the midterm election of 98, there was some noticeable redshift in about a half a dozen states that were of consequence, where Senate and House races, the exit polls showed that the Democrats won, and in fact the machines, this is when machines were first starting, the machines showed that the Republicans won. But it got much bigger in 2000, it got really big in 2002 and 2004, and it has since eased off slightly.
But the only way, if they are corruptible, if they have been corruptible, we know they are corruptible.
There's no such thing as a computer that's not. Truly,
right. The only way they can truly use it is if the polling is close. If the polling is outrageous, 10, 20 points, obviously they it doesn't make any sense to try to corrupt the machine. If the Republicans truly wanted to help our election process, they probably ought to talk to Carter, because I think he would probably be the expert on this, and yet none of them do. So obviously that's not their intent, is to improve our elections.
Well, if it was their intent to improve our elections, they wouldn't be, you know, knocking 5-10 million people off the voting rolls. But you're talking about the Carter Center, which all over the world has watched and monitored elections to determine if they were fair or not, and typically using exit polls. And in fact, the ways that we overthrew a couple of people in some of the former Soviet states that had tried to game the system and was with exit polls. You know, the exit polls didn't match the results, and so we said, that's not a legitimate election. And if only the same were true in 2004. Excellent point. So, Nate, you're suggesting that the reason why the Republicans are pounding on this notion that the polls are virtually neck and neck is because they intend to steal them with the voting machines.
They want to make us disbelieve the polling and not trust the polling. So whatever happens in the end, you know, they have it out.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. Nate, thanks a lot for the call. And in fact, I would say that they've done that in the past. Liz in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to 1350 AM. Hey, Liz, what's up? Liz? No, Liz. Charles in Princeton, New Jersey. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I wanted to talk about that voter fraud stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about the first congressional district in Maryland where the congressional candidate, Wendy Rosen, they found out that she actually was voting in both Maryland and in Florida? Because it's a little hard for me to believe that she's only one in a million in terms of committing voter fraud.
I frankly don't know. Was she a Republican or a Democrat?
No, she was a Democrat running in the first congressional district on the Eastern Shore.
The one who has pulled out of the race.
So I'm supposed to believe she's just this rare occurrence that nobody ever does this sort of stuff. I don't believe that people.
As a matter of fact, I think so.
Doing that?
Charles, if you know, George Bush spent $74 million looking for people doing that kind of thing. Mitt Romney, I mean, we know now Mitt Romney was not living in Massachusetts when he bragged that he voted there in Massachusetts. He was living in Utah. And yet in the primaries, he says, you know, I voted in that election just so I could vote against Teddy Kennedy. He didn't own a home in Massachusetts. He had no residence in Massachusetts. In fact, it turns out when he ran for governor of Massachusetts, he was still, for tax purposes, claiming Utah as his legal residence. He lied to the citizens of Massachusetts saying that he had filed tax returns in Massachusetts. He later had to amend his returns to do so. So that, you know, to comport with his lie, just like with his, oh, I never paid less than 13% in income taxes. Oh, so we're not going to count $2 million or three or whatever it is in charitable contributions to the Mormon Church this time around. But the fact of the matter is, you know, okay, you have identified one person who apparently illegally voted and is, you know, got nailed for it. And down in Florida, the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, has found one guy, an Austrian citizen who became a Canadian citizen who lives in Florida and used and claimed American citizenship to get his guns and his gun license. But even beyond that, let's say that there's a couple hundred people a year who do this. Are you really insane enough? And I lack a better word. You know, I'm kind of sick and twisted and stuff like that kind of comes to mind. But I think, frankly, just dumb enough. Really, that's the question. Are you really stupid enough to suggest that the cost-benefit equation, the cost-benefit ratio, I mean, this This is an argument that Republicans have been making forever, right? Oh, we can't have seatbelts in cars because they're going to cost an extra $3 per car, and that's going to make cars unaffordable. We can't have mileage standards in cars because that's going to make them too expensive. The cost-benefit ratio just doesn't work out. I mean, Republicans have been making this argument forever. Are you telling me that the cost of throwing millions, 4, 5, 6, 8, and maybe as many as 10 million Americans off the legitimate voters off the voting rolls is paid for with the benefit of catching 20, 30, maybe 100, maybe 1,000 people nationwide who are voting in two states, or who, like Mitt Romney, are voting in one state when they actually live in another? You really think that's a reasonable cost-benefit ratio? I'm sorry, most rational people don't. Most rational people know that when Paul Weyrich laid this thing out back in 1980 in front of a group of Republicans, you know, Republican Christian activists, when he was helped running the Reagan campaign, that he was just telling the truth. This is the guy who founded ALEC, which is the author of these laws that have been passed in all these states. Here he is, the guy who helped run the Reagan campaign, helped run the George Herbert Walker Bush campaign, helped run the George W. Bush campaign, who co-founded the Heritage Foundation and the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, the author of these voter suppression ID laws. Here he is, Paul Weyrich.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Right. So you're going to tell me that elderly people who can't make it down to the DMV shouldn't be allowed to vote because maybe, well, because we have two, we have now two examples of voter fraud, a Democrat and a Republican. That elderly people shouldn't be allowed to vote, that the 25% of African Americans who live in big city, well, 25% of African Americans who don't have the kind of photo ID that is necessary in many of these states, that they should not be allowed to vote, that the 23%, 24% of Latinos who are actually U.S. citizens, but who don't have that kind of ID because, you know, they never had enough money to buy a car, that the 19%, 18, 19% of 18 to 24-year-olds should not be allowed to vote? Seriously? Because you got one Democrat and one Republican?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That anybody would even make that argument is a really sad commentary on the state of, I suppose, public education in America.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Doug in Houston, Texas. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to talk about this one case of the lady who was running for Congress in Maryland that the Republicans keep bringing up over and over on every single left-wing
right-wing
talk radio show,
yeah.
Every right-wing talk radio show.
Well, they call into the left ones, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Well, they bring it up on theirs so that they can gin up their audience.
Right.
Voter ID laws, like the one they tried to pass here in Texas, wouldn't actually, or did pass here but got struck down, wouldn't actually prevent that.
You're right. Because assuming that she actually did vote that way, and as far as I know, an allegation has been made, and she pulled out of the race, which is, you know, generally implies guilt. But,
yeah.
But she's not in jail, to the best of my knowledge, and it is a crime. You know, voter fraud is, or election fraud, voter fraud is a crime.
Yeah.
But you're right. One of those was an absentee ballot. Maybe both were. And voter ID laws don't stop that.
If they really wanted to stop that kind of voter fraud, then they would actually call for a national database or a system of where you apply for voter registration in a new state, you have to turn in your voter registration card from your old state or your driver's license.
Right.
You know, where they would do the lookups.
And you know, there was a discussion of that during the Clinton administration of having a national ID. And the Republicans were the ones who shot it down. They got absolutely hysterical about it. This is Big Brother. This is, they're going to track all of us. We're not going to have any privacy. And I was actually with the Republicans on that. I don't think that we should have a national ID card. I don't like the idea of living in a country where an authority figure can walk up to anybody on the street and say, may I see your papers, please? I prefer living in a country where, you know, people can't accuse you of a crime, or at least you can't, you know, be come after for a crime unless there is some evidence of it, the Fourth Amendment. And
right.
And showing up at an election poll is not on its face evidence that you intend to commit a crime. And therefore, I think that, you know, we need to go after people after the fact, not before the fact. I think that the states that allow challenges to voters are actually in violation of that basic tenet of American jurisprudence that you're innocent until proven guilty. So,
well, I just know, like, when I moved to Florida at one time, and I went and got my driver's license there, they must have updated Michigan because my driver's license in Michigan was revoked.
Hmm.
You know, because, you know, they
because they knew you'd moved.
Their system, so why can't they do that for voter registration?
Yeah, it should be a fairly straightforward process. But again, that's going to require a national database of U.S. citizens. And there are a lot of people who are very wary of that, particularly Republicans, but I'll put myself in that category. I think that there are, you know, a lot of us who just think this is much ado about nothing. This is a non-issue. This has never been an issue in the United States, except back when it was, oh, we can't have people voting who aren't literate, and which was code for who aren't white, or we can't have people voting who don't pay the poll tax, which was, you know, code for who are not white or who don't own property. I mean, we've been through a lot of iterations of this. This is just the most recent iteration of it. It's pure and simple. This is what it is. It's voter suppression. Doug, thank you for the call. Laura in Chicago. Hey, Laura, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I'm a member of the Illinois Ballot Integrity Project, and we're even facing it here in Chicago. You would think that is not going to be here, but it is.
What's the it you're talking about?
Yeah, the Republican group Defend the Vote is coming in with 500 poll watchers to challenge voters in Chicago.
Are you talking about True the Vote? Is that the?
Yeah. Nope. Defend the Vote.
Oh, Defend the Vote. So there's another one.
Yeah. Yep. It's a Republican organization. They want people to volunteer as poll watchers and also as election judges. They talk about finding voter fraud. They have a little magnifying glass. They're going to find the voter fraud.
Right.
In Chicago,
right.
And so they're really wreaking havoc everywhere. I would really encourage everyone in Chicago to please go to our site, Illinois Ballot Integrity Project, and that's ballotintegrity.org, and sign up to be a poll watcher. We want to be in the same polls that they are, because we know that they're going to be challenging voters, and they can really wreak a lot of havoc just challenging everyone.
And they've been doing it forever. I mean, this is how really William Rehnquist, who ended up Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, this is how he got started in politics, in Republican Party politics, was he was living outside of Phoenix, and he would show up at the largely Native American and Hispanic area polling places, and he was a very tall guy. He was like 6'2 or something, a very, you know, relatively imposing figure, and he would loudly challenge voters to the point that people would just step out of line. They didn't want to put up with the hassle. They didn't want to be, you know, harassed like that. So, this is nothing, and that was in the 60s. So this is nothing new. Laura, good luck on that. I wish you the very best. Keith in Elkton, Maryland. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing, man?
Good.
It's a pleasure, man.
Thank you. We just have a minute
man.
To the end of the show, though, so
okay.
Go for it.
No, I just wanted to talk about have your input on the, remember the 2004 in Ohio?
Yeah.
The exit polls never matched the result.
That's correct.
But nobody talks about that.
Well, I talked about it a fair amount, but you're right. To this day, you know, the fact that exit polling, which was the gold standard in America for years and years, I mean, for a century, for more or less, and is all around the world. I mean, in a lot of European countries, in Germany, for example, they vote on paper. They don't actually know the outcome of the election for a couple of days. It takes a while to count all that paper. But they call the elections within 10 minutes of the polls closing because they've got the exit poll results. And this is true all over the world. Exit polls used to be the gold standard. And then once we got these electronic voting machines, they started going nuts, which should tell us something. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, conservatives and libertarians continue to push the big lie about our social safety nets. I'll challenge Nick Gillespie of the Cook-funded Reason magazine. Plus, geeky science rocks. Can you smell the psychopath in the room? And the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, not a spectator sport. Participate. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.